Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page with the headline across the top of the page, Banks Returning to Growth Mode Here. This article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a Dateline of Raleigh. Two North Carolina banks are expanding operations in North Raleigh to accommodate growth in their business and their employee base in the Triangle. North State Bank has acquired a three-story office building where its original bank branch is still located on Falls of Neuse Road to make room for the bank's burgeoning home mortgage business. And BB&T Bank is building a two-story financial services center on Six Forks Road near North Hills, as well as making plans to build a new bank branch at the intersection of Falls of Neuse and Litchford Road in North Raleigh. North State Bank President and CEO Larry Barber says that while his bank's operations have not grown exponentially in recent years, its home mortgage company that was formed with the acquisition of Affiliated Mortgage of Raleigh in 2010 has more than doubled in size. We've not been trying to grow it very fast, but our people are good, and with low interest rates and refinancing, they've been picking up a lot of new business, Barber says. Ken Sykes, president of North State Bank Mortgage, estimates the group approved about 1,200 home mortgage loans in 2011, and it is on pace to surpass 3,000 loans in 2012, or a 150% increase. Since the acquisition, North State Bank Mortgage has approved about $1.2 billion in mortgage loans, Barber says. To put that in perspective, Affiliated Mortgage had 11 people when it was acquired by North State Bank, and the group now has a full-time staff of 33 people. There have been growing pains, but the bank has been generous with its support staff for those growing changes, Sykes says. Part of the proposed changes is the relocation of the mortgage group from the bank's North Hills office building to the building at 6200 Falls of Neuse Road that North State Bank purchased in late November. The bank paid $3.3 million for the 48,000-square-foot Northridge Office Plaza building that was built in 1981 and was owned by a group of Raleigh investors led by Jim Anthony, CEO of the Colliers International Real Estate Firm in Raleigh. The bank had been a tenant in the building since it was founded in 2000 and still had 5 years left on its lease, Anthony says. North State Bank had also built the 20,000-square-foot building at the corner of Falls of Neuse and Spring Forest Road in 2009 for its headquarters after purchasing part of the parking lot for the North Ridge Office Plaza building from Anthony's group. It was a great buy for them, Anthony says. He says his group had offers from people who wanted to put up multifamily housing, but we couldn't sell it because the bank had such a long term left on its lease in the building. Barber says he felt it was important that the bank take ownership of the Northridge Plaza building so it could move forward with renovations to the building and accommodate relocation of the mortgage company. I like having the head of my mortgage division only a few steps away as we plan more for the future, Barber says. And the next article on the front page takes up the rest of the front page. First at the top in a on a red line at the top, it has cover story. Then under that, there's a beige background. On top of that, the headline in bold black lettering at the top, goal met, but was it the right goal? And then under that, there's a large picture of a man working in a lab. The caption reads, lab work. At Novartis, employee works on the company's vaccine technologies at its new plant in Holly Springs. And then under that, there's a subheadline. With U.S. help, Novartis will distribute vaccines quicker, but efficacy still lacking. And with this, there are actually two articles. First, we'll start with the first article. They're both written by Lauren K. Onsorge. The big steel tanks may give off a microbrewery vibe, but what's inside them is not a concoction you'd want to drink. The tanks are actually bioreactors, and the liquid churning in them is flu vaccine, of a type that is unique to Novartis and to the United States. Novartis is upping its stake in the battle against seasonal flu, and it's making its 600-person operation in Holly Springs the battleground, with a plan that could lead to the production of pandemic-ready vaccines faster than ever before. And the world is watching. But the question some industry insiders say is whether the company is right to focus its resources on production instead of working to develop a more efficient vaccine. The Basel, Switzerland-based global company, locally helmed by Holly Springs site lead Chris McDonald, in November netted U.S. Food and Drug Administration approval for Flucelvax, spelled F-L-U-C-E-L-V-A-X, a vaccine developed through a new technology first used by Novartis at a facility in Germany. While the vaccine itself is of importance, the technology used to make it, which can be replicated, is of prime interest in healthcare circles. U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius said in November that the technology could, quote, provide a more rapid startup of the vaccine manufacturing process, potentially increasing our nation's health and security, unquote. This month, Novartis is readying to transfer its technology to Holly Springs, a lengthy process that's expected to be completed in mid-2013. If all goes as planned in 2014, the new vaccines could reach consumers, meaning a bulk up of operations and even more international interest in the Triangle. It's the culmination of a deal whose first real milestone hit in 2009 when the ribbon was cut at the Triangle plant. And so far, it appears to be an instance in which U.S. government money, $760 million of it for Novartis's flu efforts, may be fulfilling the reason for which it was spent. In fact, Novartis is the first of six companies awarded contracts in 2006 to have gained approval for what it was contracted to do. The collaboration is working, McDonald says. Not so fast, say some critics who concede it appears the collaboration will result in the delivery of vaccines faster, but they lament in the rush to assure future flu vaccines get to more Americans faster, one important factor was omitted, creation of a better vaccine. The history. The DHHS, fueled by an avian flu panic that hit nearly a decade ago that found the nation unprepared, responded by putting out calls for projects to address the problem. Novartis answered the call and netted two contracts with a DHHS division, BARDA, B-A-R-D-A, Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, in 2006. One contract called for the development of the Flucelvax technology for producing bulk pandemic flu vaccine. The second was for the development of a compound known as a dose-sparing agent that allows for smaller dosages to be effective. Novartis's agent is known as MS-59. The $760 million pledged by the U.S. went both for the technology and for a portion of the cost to build the $1.2 billion vaccine plant in Holly Springs. MS-59 will be used only in the event of a pandemic, says McDonald. By using it, more vaccine would become available in the case of a widespread outbreak. Ground was broken on the Holly Springs facility in 2007. Its government-mandated mission ultimately will be to produce 150 million doses of flu vaccine within 6 months in the event of a pandemic flu, a milestone Novartis met in 2009, though not at the Triangle facility. In the 2009 pandemic, vaccines were shipped in from Europe, and when the next one hits, we'll make those vaccines here, McDonald says. The plan and the science. Novartis has already moved necessary equipment to Holly Springs. The next step is validating that the vaccine created here is equivalent to the vaccine already being made in Germany. When that data is compiled, it will be filed with the FDA, which will decide on a license. Somebody will isolate the virus from wherever it's breaking out, and we'll start manufacturing vaccines against that particular virus, McDonald says. Dr. William Schaffner, chair of the Department of Preventative Medicine at the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine, says the technology is quite different than anything that's been done before in the U.S. The conventional way to manufacture influenza vaccine is by growing out the virus in fertilized hen's eggs, he says, adding that scientists have been doing that for more than 50 years. Manufacturers got that method approved, they were committed to it, and it just grew, and since influenza vaccines were generally a low-profit product, there was not much motivation for the manufacturers to undertake a major research, he says. But in the wake of the flu panic in the early 2000s, U.S. government money suddenly made development of flu vaccines a more lucrative endeavor for pharma companies. Speed to market became an imperative. It became apparent that if we were to have a pandemic, a new virus appearing on the scene, you would like to manufacture a vaccine absolutely as quickly as possible, Schaffner says. Gearing up the roosters and the hens and the eggs takes a finite amount of time. That's when researchers in Europe, with Novartis leading the charge, had a breakthrough in cell-based technology. Researchers realized that thickened mammal cells could house the vaccine. You create the cells in test tubes, as it were, and then you can put them in the deep freeze and take them out when you need them, Schaffner explains. It reduces the time it takes to create the vaccines and means people who are allergic to eggs have a vaccine option. Viruses also seem to adapt to the technology more readily. Is faster better? If licensed, Novartis's Holly Springs facility would be the only one in the United States with the technology. But does faster mean better? Mike Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, doesn't think so, and even questions the speed-to-market claims, pointing out that in 2009's pandemic, vaccines utilizing the technology didn't make it to the market any sooner than traditional egg-based vaccines. But even if the technology is typically faster, he says that doesn't make the vaccines any better than what are currently on the market. What's important is what is the antigen being used, the material that actually immunizes you, he says, adding that the vaccine itself has largely been unchanged for several decades. If you can just grow more of it faster, it's kind of like putting a 1945 transmission in a 2012 car. Well, we need our 2018 transmissions in 2012 cars. He calls the new technology an intermediate step forward, but not one that will make the vaccine any more effective. Schaffner agrees. We recognize it is not an ideal vaccine, he says. There is work going on. It's not as if the world is static. But in the meantime, rather than sitting around waiting for perfection, we have to do the best we can with what we have available. And now we have that second article in this same area. And this one has the headline, with U.S. help, Novartis will distribute vaccines quicker, but efficacy still lacking. The flu shot isn't as effective as you might think. When the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy, or CIDRAP, examined vaccine efficacy from 1967 to 2012, flu shots ended up with a failing grade. They protect healthy adults aged 18 to 64 at a rate of about 59%. We still want people to get the shot, lead report author Michael Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, says. It's better than nothing. But it's not good enough, he insists. While Novartis's Flucelvax technology for producing vaccines promises more doses made quicker, it doesn't address what Osterholm and team say is the big problem, efficacy, particularly with at-risk populations such as the elderly. We can no longer accept the status quo with regard to influenza vaccine research and development, says Alfred Sommer of Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, who served as chairman of an advisory group to CIDRAP's vaccine study. Only with new game-changing vaccines can we ever really be prepared for the next influenza pandemic. The game change is happening, says Dr. William Schaffner, chairman of the Department of Preventative Medicine at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. Schaffner is among those volunteering to participate in a Sanofi placebo trial that looks at what happens when four times the normal amount of vaccine is used in a flu shot. That high-dose vaccine candidate is intended for patients 65 and older. Scientists are also looking at different delivery methods, such as another Sanofi innovation, a shot with an intradermal injection, meaning a needle that doesn't go all the way through the skin, and an already approved nasal spray. But Osterholm and team say delivery innovations aren't necessarily addressing a vaccine's effectiveness. To create better efficacy, a new thought process is required, and it has to happen outside of the lab and in the investment community, Osterholm says. Investors don't want to pool money into flu vaccine research because of the errant perception that what's already on the market works. Investors don't see a return on investment because how do you compete against a vaccine that appears to be highly effective? He explains. Until we can change that paradigm and have people understand that we do desperately need new and better flu vaccines, no one is going to invest. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the biz column. The headline that starts it off, Mulkey daughter launched business to help seniors. Barbara Mulkey, founder and chairman of Mulkey Engineers and Consultants in Raleigh, is following one of her passions in starting a company with her daughter, Allison Mulkey, that will be an advocate for senior citizens and their families in the region. Through their newly launched company, Local Daughter, Mulkey says she and her daughter will be working with the families of local senior citizens who may need assistance in making sure they are well taken care of in terms of health care advocacy, getting to medical appointments, and paying bills on time. We want to be that local daughter for a select number of senior age clients and their adult children who could use someone to provide various services with the same love and compassion of a daughter, Mulkey says. Mulkey's career background has been in business and engineering fields. Experience, she says, has helped her care for several aging parents and grandparents in her family over the years. Although Allison's background includes a degree in health economics and jobs working with Allscripts, Wachovia, and most recently, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina. Allison will be taking the lead in a major segment of the business, insurance advocacy. Barbara Mulkey says, most individuals just do not know the right questions to ask or where the gray areas are with insurance and Medicare that can be negotiated. In other words, she has an insider's view from the health insurance company perspective. After heading up operations for luxury home builders Toll Brothers for almost 18 years in the Triangle area, Tom Anhut is leaving the company. Biz hears Anhut will be working with Toll until the end of the year and will be assisting Toll Division President Dave Kelly in the transition. No word on what's next for Anhut, but here's hoping he stays in the Triangle. It was a little more than 2 years ago when Anhut was named president of Toll Brothers operations in the Carolinas and Georgia, including new home divisions in Raleigh, Charlotte, Atlanta, and Hilton Head. Biz remembers the day when the Briar Creek area in northern Wake County was nothing but pasture land. Anhut was in charge of developing the community for Toll, which by any standards is one of the most successful residential communities in the Triangle. The former Rapid Scan building on Reliance Avenue in Apex has been sold for nearly $1.8 million to a distribution group affiliated with Chinese light bulb manufacturer Plusrite Electric. Plusrite and its North American affiliate, Fanlight Corporation of Ontario, Canada, established an East Coast distribution hub in an East Raleigh warehouse a couple of years ago, and now the group is more than doubling its operations here with the purchase of the 31,500-square-foot building in Apex. Fanlight sells both high-intensity discharge, or HID, lamps and LED lighting products. In the U.S., it also has a West Coast distribution center in California. John Aboud with Coldwell Banker Commercial Trademark Properties represented Fanlight in the deal, and Brian Everett with Avison Young represented the seller of the property, OFM Incorporated owner Abel Zalkberg of Cary. The Sierra Club has named the Triangle's proposed rail system as one of its 50 best transportation projects in the United States, while declaring that the 50 worst include two North Carolina Department of Transportation projects in the western half of the state. The Triangle project could include as many as three lines, depending on whether Wake County follows Orange and Durham in approving the plan. One planned line runs from the campus of UNC Chapel Hill to Duke University and then to downtown Durham. A second runs from there through downtown Raleigh to Garner. A third runs from near Apex through downtown Raleigh to Wake Forest. The Sierra Club says the plan is likely to concentrate growth in corridors, allowing for efficient transportation, and likely encourage walking and cycling. The club criticized a proposed half-mile tunnel in Graham County as unnecessary and likely to pollute rivers. It also panned a proposed Monroe Bypass, a 20-mile toll road planned to run from southeastern Mecklenburg County into Union County. Biz hears Governor-elect Pat McCrory is extremely interested in what the executive board of the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce has to say about the state's economic development efforts and how they help Wake County and surrounding counties. McCrory met with the board in the past few days and asked members to suggest names of Republicans and Democrats who might be considered for the next Secretary of Commerce, the point person for the state in trying to bring in new jobs. Current Secretary of Commerce Keith Crisco may stay over with the new administration if both parties are in agreement, Biz is assuming. While the chamber has not officially or unofficially offered any names, Biz hears some individuals have been told about McCrory's search for problem-solving talent. Biz is yet to receive a call, official or unofficial. The Museum of Durham History netted a $47,145 grant from the Durham City Council to improve its history hub. Part of the money will go toward installing a map of local heritage sites and an interactive touchscreen display. A Raleigh homeowner is suing Bank of America and Freddie Mac, alleging that they seized her townhouse and pushed out her tenant after confusing it with a neighbor's house. The woman, Susan Curidan, says she didn't even have a mortgage with Bank of America. The Charlotte-based bank made the mistake in part because the addresses on the street were renumbered in 2009 after the neighbor took out the mortgage, Curidan alleges. Freddie Mac, which is formerly known as the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation, returned control of the house earlier this year. The company was about to sell the house but had to change course when the buyer's attorney discovered through a routine title search that Freddie Mac didn't actually own it. Meanwhile, Curidan says she hasn't received any rent payments since her tenant saw the foreclosure notice in December 2011. The tenant left in April when the bank offered cash, according to the lawsuit, filed November 26th in Wake County Superior Court by Chapel Hill attorney Jim White. Curidan hasn't found a replacement tenant, according to the suit. Bank of America and Freddie Mac knew or should have known that this high-volume, low-cost approach to foreclosure proceedings would necessarily lead to serious errors, White writes. They were willing to accept a certain amount of serious errors in the foreclosure process in exchange for speed and lower costs. North Carolina State University is helping to lead a federal effort to lower the cost of solar energy systems. The university is working to create standard PV components and system designs that can be adapted simply to any residential roof and can be installed and connected to the grid quickly and efficiently. It's funded from $29 million in grants from the U.S. Department of Energy. The funded projects are aimed at improving grid connections and reducing installation costs so that families and businesses can benefit from solar technology. The Energy Department is also investing $8 million in projects to help utilities and grid operators better forecast how much solar power solar energy plants will produce. It's an initiative that, in part, will be embarked on by IBM. The effort behind the program is called the SunShot Initiative. Contributing to Biz were staffers Chris Bagley, Amanda Jones-Hoyle, Lauren Onsorge, and Jason DeBrun. And now we return to our full-length stories in the Triangle Business Journal. The first article we come to is written by Chris Bagley with the Dateline of Morrisville. The headline, As Subsidies Near End, Grid Firms Shrink. Metering companies have shed scores of jobs in recent months as utilities burn through the last of the federal money that was available for upgraded electricity meters, people in the industry say. The cuts amount to 5% to 20% of the company's total headcounts in the Triangle, company spokespeople and former managers say. Itron Incorporated, for example, has slimmed down to just under 200 jobs in Raleigh, a 5% reduction, spokeswoman Allison Malahan says. Several large smart metering projects in North America are nearing full deployment, which mainly impacts the electric segment of our business, Malahan says. Current and former managers at other companies report equal and larger cuts. People in the industry say the cuts aren't entirely unexpected, given the limited nature of the federal subsidies and the ebbing demand for new meters in a rapidly maturing market. Federal grants from the American Recovery and Investment Act of 2009, commonly known as the stimulus bill, cover half of utilities costs in many cases. Utilities often pay $200 or more per unit, but they and their customers recoup the cost by becoming more efficient in delivering and using the gas, electricity, and water. Analysts estimate that utilities have spent 70% to 80% of the allotted federal funds. The industry consulting firm Pike Research estimates that manufacturers will ship about 7.2 million smart meters in 2013 in North America, down from 12.4 million in 2011. They staffed up for a tsunami of orders, and now we've gotten back to a more normal business environment, says Jesse Burst, founder and chief analyst at the industry publication Smart Grid Newsletter. It's a little bit of a boom-bust cycle, says Dean Chuang, an analyst with IDC Energy Insights. Burst and Chuang weren't aware of job cuts at any specific company, but they say the reductions are not surprising in light of other industry trends. Liberty Lake, Washington-based Itron, the largest publicly traded metering company with a presence in the Triangle, reported North America revenue of $803 million in the first 9 months of 2012, down 6% from 2011. The steepest reductions came in revenue from gas and electricity meters. And we'll stop there with this article as the it continues on with estimates of the job losses at other similar companies. And our next article is in the center of the page. It has a black border around it. Within that border, first at the top third is a aerial photograph of some land. The caption reads, "Valuable land. Land is cleared on a site at the corner of High House Road and Davis Drive in Cary, where a Publix supermarket is expected." And then under that, in bold black lettering, is the headline, "Going Publix, Cary intersection in lead as first triangle site for Florida grocer." And then also within the article, there's another map showing that area that's bounded by Cornerstone Village, Stone Creek Village, and Bradford, along that High House Road and Davis Drive intersection in Cary. This article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a dateline of Cary. The nearly $60 million Bradford development project at the intersection of Davis Drive and High House Road in Cary is emerging as the favored site for the first Publix supermarket store in the Triangle. The Lakeland, Florida-based grocery chain has not officially declared its intentions to expand into the Triangle, but multiple retail sources say the company has verbally committed to opening an anchor store at Bradford. The Cary location could open as early as 2014 and would likely be the first of several stores that Publix is expected to open here as it builds its brand among Triangle shoppers. Publix announced earlier this year that it will open its first store in the Charlotte region in 2013, and spokeswoman Maria Bros says the company is actively looking for sites across North Carolina. The company is also opening a new division office in Charlotte in 2013. The Charlotte store will be the first in the Tar Heel State for the southeastern grocer. Jeff Furman, development director of Raleigh operations for Northwood Raven, the development company for Bradford, confirms that the Cary project will have commercial buildings with about 120,000 square feet for retail, restaurant, and commercial space, including a 49,000 square foot building suited for a grocery store. But he says no lease contract has been signed for any of the commercial space. "We are negotiating with some tenants that are new to this market that will be well received," Furman says. "We look forward to a more formal announcement in late winter or early spring." Construction of new roads and the first apartment buildings at the 42-acre Bradford site, located in the northeast quadrant of the intersection of Davis Drive and High House Road, started in July. The first of 390 apartment units planned at Bradford should be ready for occupancy in the fall of 2013. Northwood Raven is investing about $1.5 million in road and infrastructure improvements at Bradford, including installation of additional traffic signals to help accommodate an expected increase in auto traffic, as well as the installation of several public art pieces. "We are hoping this will give us a ton of momentum to deliver a true village quickly," Furman says. The Bradford development project faced some opposition from Cary neighbors before the project was approved in 2007, but nearby resident Tracy Santrock says a lot of the concerns have since been alleviated. It's a very upscale development, and it's like when I-540 was being built. People in Western Cary were concerned about the unknown, says Sandrock. She says that when the Stone Creek Village Shopping Center opened nearby in 2006, she and others were impressed. Once Stone Creek went in and we saw how nice it was, we were okay with the other projects. If Publix does commit to opening a store at Bradford, it will create immediate competition for at least four other grocery stores located within a two-mile radius. Harris Teeter has a store across the street in the Stone Creek Village Shopping Center, as well as a store about 2 miles away at the intersection of High House Road and NC 55. Lowe's Foods has a grocery store at the Cornerstone Village Shopping Center at the southwest quadrant of Davis Drive and High House Road, and a Walmart neighborhood market opened earlier this year at NC 55 and High House Road. Construction is also underway at Searstone, a project at the southeast quadrant of the Davis Drive and High House Road intersection. Plans at Searstone include a 169-unit continuing care retirement community, a hotel, and multiple retail and office buildings. More scrutiny may be ahead for rail concern. That's the headline on our next article, written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh. Whether the 163-year-old state-owned North Carolina Railroad Company should be required to submit U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission 10-K-style annual reports will be up to the incoming legislature. Program evaluators in the General Assembly suggested the 10-K model as a possible alternative after a recent study found that the Raleigh-based railroad company had not fully met its financial reporting requirements to the state since 2007. While not all 10-K requirements would be applicable to NCRR, many of the requirements would provide the state with more information for oversight of NCRR, according to the General Assembly's Program Evaluation Division. NCRR, with 13 employees, owns and leases track time on a 317-mile rail corridor between Morehead City and Charlotte. Norfolk Southern makes annual payments amounting to $14 million in 2011 for exclusive freight carrying rights. That's nearly 70% of the agency's revenue. Amtrak runs passenger trains on some sections of the corridor. Back in 1998, the state spent $71 million to buy out the few remaining private stakeholders in the company, pushing NCRR into the rare territory of being an exclusively state-owned corporation. While NCRR has been submitting annual financial statements to a legislative committee since 2007, program reviewers say it hasn't been reporting on such related matters as leases, acquisitions, or sales of real property or lawsuits pending. NCRR President Scott Saylor, asked to comment on the issue, says his organization will supply any additional financial information lawmakers request. The adoption of a 10-K reporting model would obligate NCRR to open the information floodgates on leases, acquisitions, or sales of real property, or lawsuits pending, and many other data categories, including market risks, disagreements with accountants and professional fees, internal controls, executive compensation, management discussion and analysis, director independence, and related transactions. Lawmakers who received the evaluation are still studying the matter. I don't know that it's got to be like a 10-K, but I certainly want more information, says State Representative Marvin Lucas, whose Program Evaluation Oversight Committee is considering the recommendation. I want to talk with other members of the committee, but anything we do, I want to make sure that it is fair, says Lucas, a Cumberland County Democrat. John W. Turcotte, director of the General Assembly's Program Evaluation Division, says NCRR officials cooperated fully during the preparation of the recent study, which also included that the railroad company is also in need of an updated business valuation. The last valuation performed before the state share buyout in 1998 put the figure at $283 million, a number considered inadequate today. How much of the corridor and the company have appreciated in value since the late 1990s would depend in large part on land prices along the 317-mile line and whether track improvements have been made, says Cameron Rex of Wilmette, Illinois-based RMI Midwest, a company that specializes in railroad valuations. A lot could have changed in over 15 years, Rex says. And now we turn to a Better World page, news about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. First, we start with the nonprofit news. Employees of Wells Fargo and Company donated $588,000 to nonprofits and schools throughout the Triangle and Eastern North Carolina as part of the company's annual Community Support and United Way campaign. All donations were funded personally by team members. In addition to a 44% year-over-year increase in donations, the one-month campaign resulted in 1,300 volunteer hours contributed by team members to a variety of nonprofits and other causes in local communities. The 2012 Expressions Benefit raised more than $97,000 for the Lucy Daniel Center's Family Support Fund. RTI International and its staff members have donated $116,200 to the American Red Cross Disaster Relief Fund for Hurricane Sandy. The total includes a $50,000 contribution RTI made on November 1 to aid relief efforts and a subsequent contribution to match the $33,100 that RTI staff members raised between November 2nd and 9th. The Raleigh affiliate of the National Christian Foundation has launched a web tool to help clients understand and see the impact of their charitable giving called the Giving Fund Dashboard. And now we have the Philanthropy News Desk column written by Todd Cohen. The headline, Brewer Takes Lead at Frankie Lemon School. And within this column, there's also a picture of a man with a tie sitting on a desk in a classroom with a student, a child, sitting behind him. The caption reads, Dan Brewer will be looking into expanding outreach. Since it opened in 1965, the Frankie Lemon School and Development Center in Raleigh has provided more than 1 million hours of free education and support for preschool and kindergarten children with special needs and their families. Now the nonprofit school has hired a president to oversee operations and its fundraising foundation and to develop a strategy to support an expansion to serve more children in more grades, including traditional students. To begin to raise more money and begin to expand the school, we need to engage more people in the community to support our services, says Dan Brewer, who joined the school on November 12 as president, a new position. Operating with an annual budget of $1.2 million and a staff of 17 people, the school serves 45 children, says Brewer, who previously was the Raleigh-based deputy director of strategic partnerships for the League of Conservation Voters in Washington, D.C. Frankie Lemon receives about 40% of its operating funds from the state to support children referred by the Wake County Public School System under a contract to provide tuition-free instruction to eligible children from all socioeconomic levels. While it operates in space at Hayes Barton Baptist Church, enrollment includes 17 children the school began serving this school year at the Jordan Child and Family Enrichment Center, a child care program operated by the Methodist Home for Children. Frankie Lemon serves children with mild to moderate disabilities, mainly Down syndrome and autism, and it focuses on language and communication skills and motor functions, providing occupational and physical therapy in addition to a traditional preschool curriculum. The school generates the bulk of its funding from its annual Triangle Wine Experience and an annual fund drive, both currently chaired by Eliza Kraft Olander, co-founder of the Apple Gold Group, parent company of franchised restaurants, including Applebee's. The three-day wine event, which will be held the first week in February and will feature winemakers and chefs from around the world, dinners at Triangle restaurants and an auction, last year netted $800,000. And the annual drive, which ends January 8, aims to raise at least $200,000. But with more requests from parents than it has openings, and with demand from parents to add more grades, Frankie Lemon wants to diversify its funding base, which currently consists mainly of parents and other individual donors, as well as foundations and corporations, says Brewer, who previously was capital campaign manager for Triangle Land Conservancy and Raleigh-based director of development for the Mid-Atlantic states for the American Red Cross. There's a desire and a need from parents to also look at what we can do to continue services beyond kindergarten, he says. Brewer says Frankie Lemon will develop a plan by July to map its strategy and invite anyone who wants to know about the school to visit. We're going to be working with the school system as well as other organizations in the community we partner with, he says, to support special needs children and their families. And now in the People on the Move section, Danny Rosen, volunteer president and co-founder of the Band Together North Carolina, a Triangle organization that uses live music as a platform for social change, received the 2012 Goodman Award for Community Service from Leadership Triangle. Girl Scouts North Carolina Coastal Pines hired Lisa Jones as CEO. She will be taking the reins from current CEO Racine Mitchell Sinclair, who is retiring from the organization at the end of January 2013. Nathan Magaha was named General Manager of the Carolina Ballet effective January 14, 2013. He joined the Carolina Ballet as its production manager in 2012 after serving as the Director of Operations at North Carolina Dance Theater in Charlotte. And now our next full-length article in the Triangle Business Journal is written by John Downey with a Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, Solar Companies in a Rush to Sign Contracts Before 2013. Solar developers have filed a raft of proposals for large projects in North Carolina during the last few weeks, hoping to lock in contract rates before regulators let those rates fall. For example, Sustainable Energy Community Development Company of Davidson, near Charlotte, has proposed almost 70 megawatts worth of new solar projects. Sean Lamond, the group's managing partner, says the move was prompted by a proposal by Progress Energy Carolinas to reduce its avoided cost rate by about 20%. That rate, based on a calculation of what it costs a utility to produce power, is the key metric for determining the minimum contract price for the solar projects 20 megawatts and smaller. Last month, Progress asked the North Carolina Utilities Commission to suspend the current rates as of December 1. The commission hasn't acted on that request, but the change could mean companies whose projects aren't already approved by regulators will have to accept lower prices for the power they sell. If the lower rates prevail, many proposed projects that are financially sound under the current rates will not be built. Others will be less profitable. Lamond's group has submitted proposals for at least two 20-megawatt projects, two 7.5-megawatt projects, two 5-megawatt projects, and a 2-megawatt project. Sun Energy One of Mooresville has filed as developer for at least four proposed projects totaling more than 58 megawatts. Two are 20-megawatt projects, and is likely to be the construction contractor for more solar developments. Duke Energy Renewables has joined the rush to file, seeking permits for at least one 20-megawatt project, one 12.5-megawatt project, and a 7.5-megawatt project. Lamond says the commission will likely resolve the deadline issue by January. After that, he says, the battle will turn to whether the rates should go on as low as Progress proposes. Solar developers also were looking at making the case that there should be a higher avoided cost rate for solar contracts since much of the electricity they generate is produced during peak demand times when utilities have higher costs. Bandwidth rolling with a $19 a month wireless phone offer. This article written by Chris Bagley with a Dateline of Raleigh. With its $19 monthly fee, Bandwidth.com's Republic Wireless phone service is digging deep to undercut the nation's lucrative cellular establishment, which rakes in an average of more than $100 per account. Bandwidth moved the service out of beta mode in early November, and CEO David Morkin says it's on track to have 50,000 subscribers by January. The goal is to expand it to 500,000 subscribers by the end of 2013, he says. Those numbers are tiny compared to the likes of Verizon Wireless, which claims about 96 million retail customers, and Sprint Nextel, which claims about 56 million customers. But Bandwidth is moving fast. It's nearly doubled its headcount since 2009. And Morkin says roughly half of the company's 300 employees work on the Republic product. As a privately held company, Bandwidth doesn't disclose detailed financial reports, but Inc. magazine reported its annual revenue at $87.4 million in 2009, and Morkin says revenue has now grown past $100 million. The key to Republic is that it runs largely on Wi-Fi wireless internet networks, including Bandwidth's own iNetwork service, rather than a network of expensive cell phone towers. In gaps between Wi-Fi zones, the connection switches over to Sprint's network without roaming fees. A student at NC State is around robust Wi-Fi 24 hours a day, Morkin says, sitting in a conference room in the company's new headquarters on the university's Centennial campus. That's not true of all cell phone users, of course, but Republic is premised on the expectation that wireless internet service will further permeate the nation. In the meantime, there are catches. Users sometimes have to manually approve the switch from one coverage zone to another, and a user has to key in a network's password the first time it's used. It's a bit of an inconvenience, I imagine, to set up a Wi-Fi network at a place you're not at frequently, like a library or a coffee shop, IDC mobile telecom analyst John Weber says. That's a little bit of a hurdle, but at $19 a month, it's going to be attractive to a lot of people. Republic and its investors are betting that hundreds of thousands of customers will overlook the inconvenience when they're saving $30 to $70 each month. Like standard national plans in that price range, Republic offers unlimited voice, text, and data. Steve Lerner, a former telecom executive and veteran Triangle investor, says he initially put money into Bandwidth because of the founder's business discipline and says that the new Republic service reflects that discipline. Bloggers at technology review sites like GigaOM and TechCrunch have been generally supportive, using phrases like massive savings and disruptive to describe the service. They also note the extra effort that tailored hardware entails. Republic is now offered only on a specially configured Motorola Defy XT handset, which costs $249. Like the Defy XT, future handsets will use Google's Android mobile operating system. Android's crucial, in fact, because outside developers can access its software code to customize it to their own purposes. Morkin says new partnerships with manufacturers will make Republic available on two additional handsets by the end of March, one that is cheaper than the Defy XT and one that is more sophisticated. Additional handsets could help Republic get to 500,000 subscribers, Weber says. iNetwork, which is more established and a larger revenue generator than Republic Wireless, carries calls and data over the internet for services including Skype, Google Voice, and 911 services. UNC Healthcare beginning to fulfill $40 million Wake Pledge. This article is written by Jason DeBrun with the Dateline of Raleigh. With its application to add 16 inpatient psychiatric beds at Wake Brook Center in Raleigh, UNC Healthcare has taken a step toward fulfilling its promise to invest $40 million in providing mental health services in Wake County. Under a letter of intent approved in October by the Wake County Board of Commissioners, UNC Healthcare agreed to assume management of Wake Brook off New Bern Avenue near Wake Med's main campus starting in early 2013. The actual investment to add those beds would be relatively small, about $754,000, but the move brings the Wake Brook facility up to inpatient level, which means it can treat psychiatric patients in a hospital setting as opposed to only at a residential setting. UNC Healthcare plans an additional investment of around $10 million for new outpatient services in that area, says Dr. Jack Naftel, vice chairman of the UNC School of Medicine's Department of Psychiatry. That's in addition to the promised $30 million for new hospital services. Wake County currently operates the Wake Brook facility and will continue to own the property and building while UNC operates the mental health facility rent-free. Through an agreement with UNC Healthcare and Alliance Behavioral Healthcare, a managed care organization, the county will continue to supplement funding at Wakebrook, says County Manager David Cook. In the annual budget, the county spends $22 million on mental health, though that includes programs at Holly Hill and other county programs in addition to Wakebrook. Any savings that come from UNC running the facility will be invested in other mental health programs, Cook says. Separate from the application to add beds, UNC announced that Dr. Brian Sheedman, a veteran behavioral health clinician, will serve as the new medical director of Wakebrook Center. Mental or behavioral health patients in Wake County and North Carolina have been increasingly bogging down emergency rooms. The North Carolina Hospital Association's Don Dalton has long said mental health patients take up an inordinate amount of care in emergency rooms across the state, and on separate occasions has called mental health care a critical need in this county and state. Further, the Treatment Advocacy Center in Arlington, Virginia, lists North Carolina as having a severe bed shortage, though it is not one of 11 states, including South Carolina, with a more advanced critical bed shortage. UNC Healthcare's move into Wakebrook facility is in part to hold up its end of a deal struck with WakeMed Health and Hospitals this summer. WakeMed had made an unsolicited bid to buy Rex Healthcare, wholly owned by UNC Healthcare. In an agreement to drop the bid, UNC Healthcare agreed to make an investment of $30 million to develop and operate a 28-bed inpatient psychiatric facility in Wake County. NAFTEL says UNC Healthcare plans to apply for the additional 12 beds in the near future. UNC Healthcare also agreed to commit $10 million to support additional mental health services. WakeMed supports UNC taking over Wakebrook and adding the inpatient beds. In North Carolina, healthcare facilities must seek approval from the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services before making large investments. DHHS regulates healthcare services, and technically, this inventory of inpatient beds is being transferred from Broughton Hospital in Morganton, which falls under the DHHS division of state-operated healthcare facilities. And in our last 5 minutes, we'll read from the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here is some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Quintiles looking to refinance $2 billion in debt. Quintiles is looking for a $2 billion loan, company spokesperson Phil Bridges confirms. The move is an effort by the Durham-based contract research organization to refinance its debt. In an emailed statement, Bridges says the company is, quote, exploring a simple financial transaction which would amend the company's existing credit agreements, unquote. He emphasizes that the transaction would lessen the interest rate on some of the company's debt by between 0.5% and 1%. This proposed action would not increase the company's debt, he adds. It would simply provide Quintiles with a more favorable interest rate given our good credit rating and the current attractive conditions in lending markets. CFOs support Simpson-Bowles plan. Most chief financial officers say federal budget deficits should be reduced through a combination of higher taxes and deep spending cuts, according to a survey by Duke University's Fuqua School of Business and CFO Magazine. President Barack Obama and the House of Representatives Speaker John Boehner are negotiating a combination of spending cuts and revenue increases, but Boehner has not explicitly agreed to raise marginal income tax rates on high earners, as Obama insists. The two men are struggling to reach an agreement that they could then sell to their respective political parties and do it by the new year, when a series of predetermined tax increases and spending cuts would begin to take effect. About 70% of the CFOs in Duke's survey predicted that they would cut capital spending if the nation goes over the so-called fiscal cliff. Pantry reports $5 million loss. The Pantry Incorporated stock price dropped more than 6% Tuesday after the company reported a fourth quarter net loss of $4.8 million. That loss compared to net income of $3.3 million in the same period a year ago. Total revenue clocked in at $2.09 billion, down from $2.18 billion in the previous fourth quarter. Shares closed at $12 on Tuesday, down 82 cents from the previous close. Regulators won't reconsider order on Duke Energy merger. The North Carolina Utilities Commission has dismissed NC Warren's request to reopen hearings on Duke Energy Corporation's $32 billion purchase of Raleigh-based Progress Energy Incorporated. The motion by NC Warren also sought to have regulators force Duke to disclose additional information about the ouster of former Progress CEO Bill Johnson and about the cost of repairing Progress's crippled Crystal River nuclear plant. RTI International acquiring MPR Associates. RTI International is acquiring Berkeley, California-based educational research firm MPR Associates. Research Triangle-based RTI has partnered with MPR on post-secondary education projects for the U.S. Department of Education for the past 20 years. MPR has offices in Washington, D.C. and Portland, Oregon, and about 80 staff members. The acquisition, which will mean MPR's incorporation into RTI's Education Studies Division, is expected to close by the end of the year. Financial details of the deal are not being disclosed. And we have time left for a quick story from Washington Watch, written by Kent Hoover. U.S. exporters like trade bill. The Senate passed legislation to establish permanent normal trade relations with Russia, sending the bill to President Barack Obama for his signature. The bill, which passed on a 92-4 vote, is a major victory for the business community. The legislation will allow U.S. businesses to expand their exports to Russia, something other nations already are doing as a result of Russia's decision to lower trade barriers by joining the World Trade Organization in August. Obama is expected to sign the bill. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.